Headlines: Iran and Venezuela launch their first direct shipping line as part of measures to boost the mutual cooperation. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in Tehran for talks over the country's nuclear program. And Russia says it will no longer rely on the West as an energy partner as tensions remain high on the Nord Stream pipeline's blasts. Welcome. Our top story: Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. The Iranian embassy in Venezuela says a ship was already dispatched to the Latin American country last month. The embassy says one ship will be sent to Venezuela every 3 months. The shipping line has been launched to support merchants and traders from both countries. Iran and Venezuela have pledged to boost bilateral ties in various fields. They have signed a 20-year strategic agreement to expand cooperation on energy and agriculture, among other issues. The document was signed last June by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to Iran. Both countries are under U.S. sanctions and are looking for alternatives to neutralize the pressure. And the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in Tehran for talks with Iranian officials. Rafael Grossi is scheduled to meet high-ranking officials, including the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. Technical nuclear issues are high on the agenda. Grossi's visit comes ahead of a meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors on Monday. Iran and the agency are at odds over several issues concerning Iran's nuclear activities. Those issues include claims that Iran has enriched uranium to nearly 84% purity. Now, Tehran has dismissed the claim. Earlier this week, Islami said there has been no deviation in Iran's nuclear activities and that ambiguities in IAEA reports have been resolved. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in a little bit more detail. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teen during a raid in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the death, saying the victim was 15-year-old. He was fatally shot in the back near the entrance to the town of Azun, east of Qalqilia. Two more teenagers were also wounded, one critically. The latest death increases the number of Palestinians killed by Israelis this year to 68. According to Palestinian media, 30 lost their lives in February alone. The death toll includes 4 killed by Israeli settlers. Joining us for more on that is Dawood Kutab, a Palestinian journalist from Amman. And we also have Wafa Al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist from Gaza City in the besieged Gaza Strip. So, Mr. Kutab, if I could start with you. We've got a situation here where a 15-year-old has been fatally shot in the back. In other words, he was either walking away from the Zionist entity's forces or running away from its forces. So he was not, in essence, posing any direct threat to the Israeli regime forces. But they still killed him. Why did they kill him?
Well, the Israeli government and Israeli Ministry of Defense has raised the agreement on what is allowed by soldiers, and they've basically given them a green light to shoot to kill anytime they feel like they want, even if their life is not in danger. And this is a big question mark of a war crime that is taking place continuously, where Israeli soldiers are not protecting themselves or anything like that, because they keep saying we have the right to defend ourselves, but they're actually assaulting Palestinians and killing them, injuring them, and continuing the terrorization of the population because they are rejecting and resisting the occupation. This is a big problem, and it falls within the policies of the Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich governments, which has claims that the West Bank is part of the Jewish people's rights and that they will annex it anytime they want. And so they feel like they are running their own country, even though it occupied territories by international law.
Okay, let me turn to Wafa al-Odaini. You know, so we're seeing a record Palestinian death tolls this year. Two massacres already, one in Nablus, one in Jenin before that. Settlers going on the rampage, and then we have, now we've got the Zionist regime wants to execute Palestinian prisoners who had conducted retaliatory operations. What's your take on that?
Actually, this is not bizarre for the occupation authorities. Indeed, the Palestinian detainees inside the occupation jail, they endure all kind of ill-treatment and torture and subjugation. And for your information, like over than 250 Palestinian inmates lost their lives inside the Israeli occupation custody while they are in their custody. And indeed, they witnessed the slow death inside the occupation jail. But now with this draft bill, you know, they mean to heat the Palestinian arena, because the Palestinian people will never allow this thing to happen to Palestinian detainees, to their sons inside the Palestinian occupation jails. And actually, you know, that this death penalty, it is against the Israeli authorities' law. So they just want to practice it against the Palestinian detainees, not against the Israeli settlers when they commit any crime in their you know, state, as they claim.
Okay, I just want to go back to Mr. Kotab. You know, Mr. Kotab, we talk about the massacres that we witnessed this year in Jenin and Nablus, and you know, the newly formed Palestinian resistance factions in both cities, both occupied cities, they were very heroic during those massacres. They lasted. The Israeli, the Zionist entity, the occupation, dispatched special forces. And the massacre, they resisted, these youth in both cities resisted for 3 hours until they forced, albeit the Israelis committed massacres, but they forced the Israelis out of the two cities. Do you want to share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, in military and political terms, both the Jenin and the Nablus raids were a big failure. Yes, they killed a number of Palestinians, but the whole idea that they entered into areas that are under the Palestinian control under the guise of that they're seeking people who shot at them. But in the meantime, because of the long resistance, as you said, the heroic resistance, they were shooting everybody around them, and as a result, the West Bank erupted in revenge attacks, including in Jerusalem and then in Jericho and so on. So the cycle of violence, instead of being down, it has been revived, and the Palestinians are in a more courageous move now that they are not taking the Israeli orders and Israeli terror into account, and they are heroically standing up for their people. Now, of course, that has weakened the authority of President Abbas and his ability to represent Palestinians. And now these armed groups are becoming very popular in the Palestinian areas, and they pose a threat to the political powers, which are not doing anything in their eyes to protect the Palestinian population and to bring an end to the occupation. So this is where we're at today.
Right. Wafa Al-Odeini, speaking of President Abbas, we saw the Palestinian Authority hold the talks with the Zionist entity in Jordan to de-escalate tensions in the occupied West Bank. Do you see anything, any points in these talks, which, you know, these talks have been going on for 70 years, perhaps you can say. Do you see any points in these kind of talks, or is the only way to liberate Palestine and to liberate Al-Quds is for the armed resistance to carry on with their retaliatory operations?
Okay, actually the negotiation and the talks with the occupation authorities, actually it is meaningless, you know. And you know that since long years, the PA negotiate and talk with the occupation authorities, but they gain nothing. If you look on the ground, you feel that there is nothing on the ground of care. All the negotiation just resulted on something or some benefit only for the occupation, but nothing occurred for Palestinians. Their situation and their condition is exacerbating every single day. As you report like many times, like every single day there is a Palestinian killed. There is a home demolition. There is seizing of land more and more. They just declare Jerusalem, all Jerusalem, as the capital of Israel. They consider Israel, they want it as a Jewish state, and they declare this many times, but it seems that the PA doesn't learn from its lesson, and they have no options but to stay as they are. And we as Palestinians, you know, as you see in the occupied West Bank, because the people there feel disappointed from this negotiation and from the coordination with the occupation. So they after 2014, they started to resist the occupation, to use the armed resistance. And you know the Lion Dens, the newly group that emerged in the occupied West Bank, they emerged because they feel disappointed from their situation. Their people are being, you know, violated. Their homes are being raided every single day. The people, so many children and women got murdered and massacred in front of the cameras, and nobody held Israel accountable for what they are doing, what their crimes against Palestinians. So that's why they resist the occupation. They use the armed resistance. And you know that the Palestinians during the past years, they use the popular resistance, but also the popular resistance is so important.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. Let me thank our guest, Dawood Kutab, is a Palestinian journalist joining us from Amman. Wafa Al-Odeini is a Palestinian activist and journalist joining us from Gaza City in the besieged Gaza Strip. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review. Moving on, Russia says it will no longer consider the West an energy partner as tensions remain high over blasts that hit the Nord Stream gas pipelines last year. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the energy policy of Russia will be oriented towards reliable and credible partners like India and China. He also said Moscow will not allow the West to blow up gas pipelines again. The blasts last year took place in September, hitting the Nord Stream pipelines carrying Russian gas to Germany. Moscow blames some Western states, including the U.S., and has called for an international investigation. They deny any involvement. Late last month, Russia called for a UN Security Council meeting over the issue. The call came after an investigative American journalist revealed that the U.S. Navy had bombed the pipelines. Ukrainian forces are struggling to hang on to their positions in Bakhmut, an eastern town that has been the site of the longest and bloodiest battle since the Russia-Ukraine war broke out. The battle for Bakhmut is raging around the clock. That's according to a senior Ukrainian military official. Now, he says the situation is critical and that Kiev needs to get its hands on more ammunition as soon as possible. Ukrainian forces are said to have repelled dozens of Russian attacks in the past 24 hours. The Russians are trying to encircle Bakhmut from the north, east and south. Capturing the town would enable them to seize the rest of the strategic Donbass region. In the meantime, the Ukrainian military has reported Russian missile attacks in central Zaporizhia region and the southern Kherson region. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A new round of political maneuvering by the International Atomic Energy Agency has enabled Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin to further pressure Iran towards their ulterior motives. Once again, the IAEA has entangled Iran in a dispute triggered by the agency's Israeli influence accusations, which were leveled against Tehran's peaceful nuclear activities at Fordo Fuel Enrichment Plant located near the Iranian city of Qom. Back in 2018, former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the landmark nuclear deal and then unleashed a wave of illegal sanctions on Iran's economy. In response, Tehran has since ramped up uranium enrichment at a considerable pace not seen since the signing of Iran nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. An ardent opponent of Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, Joe Biden's administration began negotiations to revive the deal when he took office. But Biden's policy has so far failed to resurrect the 2015 accord. The negotiations to salvage the JCPOA have been at a standstill since August 2022 due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were imposed on the Islamic Republic by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran's main demands include guarantees from Washington that future U.S. administrations will not renege on the nuclear accord once again. Iran insists that it wants a stronger language in the draft text to ensure there are no ambiguities. In addition, Iran says any agreement concerning the reviving of the nuclear deal also hinges on the settlement of safeguards issues. And without settling those issues, reviving the 2015 nuclear deal makes no sense. For a closer analysis, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. The Global Nuclear Agency, IAEA, made a confidential report a few days ago, which was leaked by Western media in violation of legal protocols. The IAEA chief reacted to the leakage, saying it was regrettable, but refusing to take responsibility for it. In the report, Grossi had accused Iran of making an undeclared change to the interconnection between the two clusters of advanced machines enriching uranium to up to 60% purity at its Fordo plant. The U.S. and its European allies issued a joint statement following the leakage of the mentioned report, accusing Iran of being inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
This is, very much the nature of the director, and he's very much in the pocket of the Western governments. When the Western governments tell him to do something, he does that. So tomorrow he could be very nice to Iran because of the dictate that he gets, or he could be very harsh to Iran because of the dictate that he gets. And this is sad because the International Atomic Energy Agency is a UN body. It's supposed to be neutral. It shouldn't engage in double standards. The previous directors of the International Atomic Energy Agency were also in line with Western policies against Iran. But Mr. Grossi is gross in terms of how he acts. There is no other way to explain that.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, dismissed the report by calling it incorrect and reiterated the fact that the IAEA reports are not published immediately by the media about any country except Iran. He also urged Rafael Grossi to maintain professional behavior and not be part of the politically motivated pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. The remarks came a week after Iran had criticized the agency over its confidential report, claiming that the accusation came despite a letter sent by Iran to the IAEA back in November, informing the agency of a decision to start enriching uranium to the purity level of 60% at its Fordo nuclear facility, and stating all the modes of enrichment that had been specified in the data questionnaire. Consistently during the January 2023 IAEA inspection, no new measure had happened that was contradictory to the November 17, 2022 questionnaire and would thus make it necessary to inform the IAEA thereof. The latest clash on Fordo comes as IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi had said last month he hopes to visit Tehran in February to hold talks with Iranian officials on the unresolved cases of nuclear particles found years ago at several Iranian sites. Iranian officials have emphasized that any trip by the IAEA head to Iran must have a specific objective in an oblique reference to the UN nuclear agency's political approach. They insist that the trip needs preparations, and the content, the aims, and the schedule of which needs to be clearly determined in advance. The agency says that Tehran has to provide technically credible answers to its questions. On its part, Iran accuses the agency of being easily influenced by Israel, a staunch critic of the JCPOA. Therefore, the Iranian officials have demanded that the IAEA probe be dropped before Iran rejoins the nuclear deal.
Mr. Netanyahu is trying to become the main player in this controversy and challenge. Please note that today, when we are talking to each other, both the Americans and Europeans are not satisfied with the negotiations process in this case. And that means they want to take it in a different direction. Why? This is a very important question. The reason is that it is no secret Iran is progressing in the nuclear technology every day. I mean, every day we announce that we have gained this or that achievement. In the next phase, we have another achievement, and all of them will be realized and announced under the supervision of the agency. It is all peaceful. So this was the first point. The next point is that these achievements are not limited to nuclear areas only. They happen every day in military areas and in Iran's missile power.
In June, the IAEA censured Iran for traces of uranium that had been found at three undeclared sites in 2019. Iran dismissed the IAEA motion as politicized and responded by removing surveillance cameras at key sites. Tehran says that the probe is based on forged evidence provided to the IAEA by the Israeli regime. It has slammed the agency for adopting a political approach and forsaking its technical mandate while maintaining that its nuclear program is strictly peaceful.
You know, it is something very amazing that the Israelis engage in assassinating Iranian scientists. They sabotage Iranian sites. They engage in a lot of activities that are against international law. And the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency visits Israel before coming to Iran.
On Iran's side, there is this very important point that time is moving forward in Iran's favor. It means that if one day we were talking about IR-1 or IR-2, today we are talking about more advanced centrifuges. If one day our concern was if we had the permission to establish this or that nuclear plant, today we build various plants under the supervision of the IAEA. If one day we were under pressure about our regular missiles, today they are worried about Iran's long-range missiles.
Iran has time and again rejected accusations of seeking to develop nuclear weapons. The country, which is an abiding member of the NPT, has agreed to put certain limits on its nuclear program by signing the JCPOA and has allowed unprecedented levels of inspections by the IAEA to reassure the world that it is not after nuclear weapons.
Due to the fact that some Western parties and those who were influenced by the Zionists published doubts about our nuclear program, we came to the conclusion to provide appropriate answers to these doubts through cooperation with the agency. We try to continue allowing the IAEA inspectors to monitor our facilities during various programs, both within the framework of the nuclear safeguards and after that, during the time when we accepted the JCPOA restrictions and supervisions. We created the possibility of high-level access for the agency in our own nuclear sites, and the IAEA has announced 15 times so far that it has not observed any deviation in Iran's nuclear program.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has also issued a religious decree declaring that the accusation, development, and use of nuclear weapons violate Islamic principles and are therefore forbidden. However, in response to the latest developments in the nuclear case, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, "Despite ill promises and obstructions created by the U.S. and E3, we remain committed to fulfilling our international obligations, but it will be within purely technical frameworks." Adding, "Under such a framework, we remain committed to negotiation to achieve tangible and practical results to first, secure maximum national interest, and second, give care to joint interests with other parties."
The Western parties suspended their commitments in the JCPOA. Contrary to the United Nations resolution, America withdrew from this agreement and did not lift the sanctions. The Europeans also failed to fulfill their obligations. In the same framework, Iran also limited its commitments in a compensatory measure and temporarily limited inspections of the IAEA. Of course, we are of the opinion that if these suspensions end, i.e., the other side is ready to lift the sanctions again, Iran is also ready to return to its obligations and allow the previous monitoring.
Accordingly, the Iranian government insists on negotiations, not merely for the sake of negotiations, but for obtaining collective results and achievements. They are seriously and categorically critical of those who have used negotiations for political and partisan games in the West. Talks to restore the nuclear deal remain deadlocked since September, with the U.S. publicly maintaining that the matter is not important to them anymore, while Tehran claims Washington is secretly sending messages to reach an agreement.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here's how it looks on the page. The National News reads, IAEA chief touts alternative to Iran nuclear deal to break impasse. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog has suggested an alternative agreement to the landmark Iran nuclear deal could break the deadlock in talks between the regime and world powers. Rafael Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said the coming weeks and months would be crucial in determining the direction the talks take. Mr. Grossi warned the Chatham House think tank in London on Tuesday against adopting a defeatist approach to the signatory's sluggish efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. I think in the case of Europe, it is very important that they continue to support us in trying to find a viable way forward, JCPOA or no JCPOA. According to Financial Times, West grapples with dilemma over Iran nuclear talks. The U.S., U.K., and EU impose new sanctions on dozens of Iranian officials and entities in their latest attempt to increase the pressure on Tehran. The U.K. is also reviewing whether to proscribe the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, while the European Parliament has called for the blacklisting of the most powerful wing of the Republic's state security forces. Yet, even as relations touch new lows, U.S. and European officials are keeping the door open to diplomacy to save what is left of the moribund 2015 nuclear deal Tehran signed with world powers. That is not because they are optimistic about a breakthrough. There have been no nuclear talks since Iran rejected a draft proposal to revive the deal agreed by the accord's other signatories in September. Instead, it is a reflection of the dilemma Western powers face as they consider their limited options to stop Iran from expanding its nuclear program. On the one hand, they fear that pulling the plug on the nuclear diplomacy would hand Iran a propaganda victory by enabling it to blame the West for the collapse. They are also weary of triggering a broader crisis by ending all avenues of diplomacy with Tehran, diplomats and analysts say. CNBC says, Iranian oil exports end 2022 at a high despite no nuclear deal. Iranian oil exports hit new highs in the last 2 months of 2022 and are making a strong start to 2023 despite U.S. sanctions, according to companies that track the flows on higher shipments to China and Venezuela. There is no definitive figure for Iranian oil exports, and estimates often fall into a wide range. Tanker tracking companies use various methods to track the flows, including satellite data, port loading data, and human intelligence. Iran generally does not release figures. According to another analyst, Vortexa, Chinese December imports of Iranian oil hit a new record of 1.2 million barrels per day, up 130% from a year earlier. Qatari Deputy Premier and Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed ibn Abdulrahman Al Thani on January 29th traveled to Iran and met with Chief Diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the Iranian capital. The U.S. has sent a message to Iran, he cryptically told a press conference in Tehran.
As we got closer to the end of the negotiations, two things happened. The first thing is that these pressures have increased. This is from America and Europe. They increased the pressure, they increased the sanctions, they put more people on the sanctions list, they strengthened different areas that put pressure on Iran. They travel to different countries and talk to the world leaders against Iran. The second thing that we usually witness is the invisible hand of the terrorist groups, which are always ready to serve. I mean, if they can't stop the process of negotiations and the parties are close to yielding results, they try to assassinate someone in Iran. A scientist, do something like this to deviate the negotiations' results. Of course, it should be mentioned that they always pay the price. Every time they assassinate someone here in Iran or do acts of vandalism, Iran responds strongly.
Local media in Iran viewed the American message as somewhat of a victory. On the other hand, some analysts insist that the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as JCPOA, is not a priority for the Joe Biden administration.
Biden administration could return to the agreement on the first day of Biden's presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris Climate Accords. Trump left these international accords through executive orders. Biden could return to these accords, just nullifying the executive order of the previous president. And he did that, but not for JCPOA. Why he didn't return to JCPOA? Because of the disagreements that existed in his administration even before. And what he could do was to return to JCPOA. It was Trump that left it. And then tell Iran, you have 2 months or 3 months to return to the setting that Iran had before Trump left the agreement. Easy solution. You don't need negotiations. You don't need 2 years of dragging your foot. You could just return to the agreement. And when Biden became president, Rouhani was in office in Iran. Rouhani was even more interested in returning to the agreement.
Without elaborating, the Qatari foreign minister stated that he was carrying a message from the U.S. about a topic related to the 2015 nuclear agreement. Amir Abdullahian confirmed that he had received the message, but did not say what it entailed.
The United States could do things to show that they're actually serious about observing the guidelines of JCPOA. For example, the one thing that needs to happen after the agreement, if U.S. returns to the agreement, is that you have companies, international companies, that want to come and invest in Iran. And if companies think that they will face sanctions in a few months or a couple of years after Biden leaves office, then they may not come because of this uncertainty. Again, doesn't make sense for Iran to follow the agreement if the next president does what Trump did. And who knows, you know, we have people like Mike Pompeo who are planning to run. John Bolton is planning to run. So obviously these people, Trump may come back to the White House. We never know.
The Iranian foreign minister told reporters that he had complained to his Qatari counterpart about the unconstructive role and interventionist measures of the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany during the recent unrest in Iran. Local newspapers saw the American message as a sign that the West had lost faith in the potential for success of the recent unrest in Iran. Some accused the West of hypocrisy and insisted that the so-called Plan B to pressure the Islamic Republic into agreeing to restore the JCPOA had failed.
There is another event that has actually changed the political arrangement about nuclear negotiations a bit, and that is the result of the events that started in mid-September. This was very decisive. Everyone noticed that when the riots broke out in Iran and conditions became volatile, the speed of the negotiations process dropped sharply and almost came to a halt. The reason was that the other side felt Iran was in an unstable condition politically and the government has lost its nation's support. It was a key moment and big lesson for the Iranian nation. Negotiations practically froze. It is not the first time, however, that we experienced something like this. In the previous rounds of negotiations, whenever anything happened in Iran, they would immediately stop negotiations, hoping that such unrest can force Iran into giving more concessions. This is how they think, but they need to know that it will never happen, and Iran will never succumb to such pressures.
Tehran has repeatedly indicated that negotiation and diplomacy with the ultimate objective of achieving joint interests and securing maximum benefits for the Iranian nation are placed high on its agenda.
From my point of view, negotiations can be concluded very quickly. The negotiations have reached the stage where the draft text is almost ready, except for one or two paragraphs on the issue of cooperation between Iran and the agency. The rest of the issues are close to a conclusion, and for this reason, we think that if the other party has a realistic approach and is ambitious, it's possible to reach the result faster. The thing that interrupted the negotiations has political backgrounds, and the other side can be blamed for it on this matter.
within the framework of Iran's foreign policy doctrine, in terms of dynamic diplomacy and smart interaction, Iran has prioritized the view to Asia as well as the immediate neighbors as its main approach. Yet Tehran has made serious efforts concurrently to enhance cooperation with Africa, Europe, the Americas, including Latin America. The government believes that Europe is not made up of only three countries that have acted unfriendly towards Iran, especially in recent months. In fact, the establishment seeks to expand relations worldwide as part of the agenda to advance its interests. In light of the recent IAEA moves, some independent political analysts have observed that, unfortunately, instrumental use of international organizations against independent countries has turned into a norm in the West's foreign policy.
When we provide this level of access to the agency investigators, this level of preparedness and response to the agency questions, why does the agency keep asking new questions? How long are these new questions going to be raised? From our point of view, more cooperation should lead to a greater understanding, but what has happened so far is that we cooperate, we provide opportunities for the agency secretariat, and they always raise questions. This approach is not fair and strongly frowned upon by the Iranian nation. The agency's recent report was in the same framework.
One side of the story, there is Netanyahu, who is trying to influence the director general of the IAEA, a person who has apparently become the agent of these political events. On the other side, America and Europe are not willing to confront Iran and have come to the understanding that such conflicts never benefit them. What they want today is to freeze and stop Iran's actions. They don't seek to shut down Iran's nuclear program because they know that they don't have the power. They want to reach an agreement that will at least convince Iran to suffice to this extent of enrichment, so that Iran does not go further. Another side of the story is Iran. In Iran, no one has any objection to sitting behind the negotiating table. However, according to the same principles that have been set many times, we are not negotiating over new issues under the pretext of JCPOA. We are not negotiating on the regional issues or Iran's missile power.
In the meantime, in reaction to EU's chief diplomat Joseph Borrell's recent remarks about the revival of the JCPOA, Iran has made it clear that it would return to its commitments under the nuclear deal whenever the parties to the JCPOA fulfill their obligations. Iran has proven in the past that it will never give in to pressure and will go on with its peaceful nuclear program proportionate to its own needs and in line with its rights and obligations under international treaties to which it is a member. As an effective and responsible member of the agency and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and as a country possessing nuclear capabilities, nuclear knowledge, and nuclear technology, the Islamic Republic of Iran has always cooperated seriously and effectively with the agency. Enemies of the Islamic Republic attempt to show that Iran does not need nuclear technology and claim that Iran is seeking atomic bombs. However, the Iranian nuclear chief has categorically rejected the enemy's claims that the country does not need nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and seeks to achieve military weapons. In an interview with a local media during the inauguration ceremony of the Nariqan uranium mine, Islami said Iran's recent nuclear achievements are meant to be used in the health, medical, environmental, and industry sectors, reiterating the peaceful nature of the country's uranium enrichment activities. Also, Islami described Nariqan mine as the biggest uranium-molybdenum mine in the country and said that creating the capacity with the aim of expanding nuclear power production and application of radiation are among the major goals pursued by the AEOI as part of the Comprehensive Strategic Plan for the Nuclear Industry. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do tune in again, same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect The Two Worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of Al-Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin alayhi salamullah. The Imam Salamullah alayhi says, and he seeks refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he says, وَاسْتِكْثَارُ الطَّعَ. O Allah, I seek refuge in you from making too much of obedience and boasting about obedience. A topic we started in the previous episode. So when it comes to ujb and pride, taking pride in what you've done for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it does give a person a sense of happiness. It gives him a sense of victory. It gives him a sense of, feeling good about himself. That itself is a good thing. As long as the person directs this happiness and this state that he's in towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he feels good that he's obedient to Allah. He feels good that he's doing what Allah wants him to do. He feels good in the sense that he says, okay, I'm trying to overcome my shortcomings. I'm trying to overcome my sins. I'm trying to become a better person for Allah. Therefore, I'm happy with myself. That is all good. And this is what sometimes might be even required for a person to even do more work, to have that state of mind where he thinks I am on the right track and I'm happy about it. But when a person becomes in that state, becomes part of him, he's saying, oh, I am the mu'min, I am the worshipper, I am the person who fasts, I am the person who gives charity. And then he attributes all these things to himself. All these attributes, he makes it part of himself and he says, I am that. And he feels good about it and then he, moves on with his life based on that. As if he has no shortcomings whatsoever. That is the problem that we need to be aware of. Let us take a short break. And then we will be back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So we were saying that having that feeling of being happy and, feeling good about what you've been doing for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a good thing, as long as you don't make it an attribute that you give it to yourself. You leave it for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because what happens is, when a person tries to bring these attributes to himself, that he's a good doer and he's a worshipper and he's this and he's that, that takes him to ujb, that takes him to pride. And pride is a sin that is committed in the heart. It's an inner sin. And the Ahlul Bayt, they said, the sin that you commit with your body parts and your body limbs is much better than the sins of the heart. Because, for example, a person can say bad words, he can swear, he can do things, he can listen to music, he can watch haram. But afterwards, he would do istighfar to the sins he committed with his own body parts, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will forgive. But when a person commits a sin within his heart, that is very hard to remove. So, for example, we have sins that are done in the heart, for example, like jealousy, or like pride, or these things that no one can see. These things become like an internal illness that is very hard to cure. Therefore, we have to be very careful. So when we read the hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he knew that sins is much better for a person than him doing always ta'a and ibadah and then attributing that to himself and becoming a prideful person. That will take him out of the way because of that. Because if it becomes a sin in the heart, then it becomes very hard to remove. Even it becomes very hard to notice as well. Because people sometimes do not notice pain unless they start to feel the pain. So a person might have cancer, but because he never felt the pain in his body parts, he thinks he's normal. And all of a sudden, he realizes that he has cancer. These diseases in the heart, they're like cancer that we cannot feel. So they become very hard to get rid of because we haven't even identified them. So al-ujub is the problem that comes from boasting about one's worship or one's good deed. So we have to be very careful in this regard. Let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So we're talking about ujub, and we're talking about when a person boasts about his worship acts. And we said this is a problem. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he narrates a story. He says, "Ata alimun abdun faqala lah." So a scholar came to a worshiper and he says to him, "Kayfa salatuk?" How is your pray? You know, how is your prayer? So the worshiper said to the scholar, "Mithli yus'al an ibadatah." Someone like me is questioned about his worship acts. Like, in a way, he's saying, how dare you ask me about my worship acts? I am the worshipper. I'm known to be the worshipper. He says, "Wa ana a'budu Allah mundu kada wa kada." You ask me this question about my salah, and I've been praying to Allah for so many years? And then the guy said to him, "Kayfa buka'uk?" How was he crying for Allah? And the guy said, "Abki hatta tajri dumu'i." He says, I cry until my tears start to flow. Then the alim said to him, the scholar said to him, فَإِنَّ ضَحْكَكَ وَأَنْتَ خَائِفْ أَفْضَلْ مِنْ بُكَاءَكَ وَأَنْتَ مُدِلُّونَ. He says to him, if you laugh while you are in the state of fear, is much better than you crying while you think that you've done so much good for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the idea here is when a person thinks he's doing so much for Allah, he's crying and he's worshipping and he's this and he's that, he is in the state of ujub, he's in the state of pride, he's in the state of him living the illusion that he's a good person. When reality, to Allah, it means absolutely nothing. Where a person could be simple, normal person, he does the wajib that Allah wants from him and nothing extra. And he is fearful of Allah. He says, well, maybe one day Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can punish me, so therefore I need to do good things. So he's in that state of fear, but he's not a worshipper as the guy that we mentioned in our story. That state is much better than having to worship you day and night, but then it goes to vain and goes to waste. So we have to be very careful. Therefore, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he says, oh Allah, I seek refuge in you from the time or the state where I start to boast about my worship acts. Me and you, we also need to do the same. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi, in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.